Welcome back to Sparkwood in 21, the No Shit Network podcast on the Showtime television series Twin Peaks. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Seb.
If you like what you hear, head on over to noshit.net where you can find all of the other podcasts that we do. If you like horror, we have Penny Dreadful and Ash vs. Evil Dead. If you're into historical, we have Vikings and Spartacus. And if you're like us, we also have A Handmaid's Tale and American Gods. Contact us through Gmail and leave a review on iTunes. Also, check out the TV Time app. It lets you keep track of all your favorite shows as well as participate in the community of like-minded fans. Check it out. It's cool.
Did you want to do an announcement, Paul?
Yes, actually, I have two announcements. Ooh, okay, so I finished a Twin Peaks-inspired series of mugs. I made them while watching the show and was really inspired by this season. So first, I've got the Double R Cafe mug with an owl on the back. Now, all you have to do to win this is go to iTunes, search for the Sparkwood in 21 podcast, and leave us a review. Then, when we do our bonus podcast at the end, I will take all the names and draw one lucky one out. So it's perfect, right? Super easy. Next, I made a really small limited series of owl mugs. Now, one's going to Em and Steve, of course. One's going to myself. We're also going to be giving one to John Bernardi for all the things that he does for the Twin Peaks community. And then one's going to be auctioned off on eBay. Now, we're doing this to raise some money for some new equipment upgrades around No Ship Network. It will be listed on Sunday the 20th under No Ship Twin Peaks Mug. There are no reserves, and I hope it goes to a fan that loves it as much as we do. So if you want to see all six mugs, go to @MoltenForge on Twitter and @NoShipNetwork on Twitter. And I hope everybody enjoys everything that we've done.
So definitely stop by one of those places on Twitter and check out the pictures of these mugs because they are awesome. I've seen a lot of Paul's work over the years, and this is definitely some of the best stuff he's done. So you will be impressed.
All right. So we are discussing Twin Peaks The Return, Part 14, also known as We Are Like the Dreamer. This was written by Mark Frost and David Lynch and directed by David Lynch. We start out in Buckhorn, South Dakota. Gordon Cole calls Twin Peaks Police Department and Lucy answers. And he's surprised by the fact that Lucy's been there the whole time. And Lucy gets into the nitty gritty detail to explain, well, I'm not here all the time. I have taken vacations. In fact, they've gone to Bora Bora. And we've actually talked a little bit about their spending. And I think this, you know, Bora Bora, for instance, if you are going to Bora Bora for a week long holiday, it starts at around $11,000 just for two people.
Wow.
Jesus Christ. That's crazy.
Well, maybe the fireman's buying them plane tickets too.
We've kind of talked about it before. This is too much of hint dropping for this not to be an issue at some point. We just don't know how it's going to pop up and what else it's going to affect in the world of Twin Peaks.
Gordon Cole's response to this is just silence.
Yeah, I couldn't tell if this was something that wasn't actually happening with him, like he didn't hear it for some reason, or if there's just a weird interdimensional thing to where when she starts talking about that, it doesn't go through the line somehow. And then the silence, and then he's just like, okay. And then she says, do you want me to patch you through to Sheriff Truman? He's like, yes, Lucy. Like, that part never happened. Like, you could just truncate that down.
Yeah. I mean, I took it as he had the same reaction almost I did. Like, is she serious right now?
Yeah, like you're saying, like, you've been there all these years? No, I went home sometimes being dead serious. Like, you stayed at that desk with your ass in the chair for 25 years.
It made me laugh.
So immediately, Cole assumes that it's Harry he's speaking to, and Frank informs him that Harry is actually in care. What was the words he actually used?
In the doctor's care?
In the doctor's care. It still hasn't actually been detailed as what Harry's affliction is. Maybe he's patient zero with whatever's happening in Twin Peaks.
Oh, that's a good call.
Everybody's assuming that it's cancer, but it could be anything. Mm-hmm. You're right. It could be some other, you know, and I like that idea that when Harry, that you put out there, that when Harry gets better, Twin Peaks gets better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that too.
We deduce pretty easily from this conversation that Frank Truman has actually put a call out to the FBI because he wanted to speak to Gordon Cole so he can inform him because he thought Gordon Cole would find this of interest about the missing diary pages that were found that indicate that there are two Coopers. So he passes this information along to Gordon Cole. Gordon Cole says he cannot comment on right now, but he is appreciative all the same. I was surprised that Frank Truman did not mention the Keep?
Like, why would that have just shown up? I mean, it's too much of a coincidence, and he doesn't say anything about it.
But it was cool to have. I really enjoyed seeing Gordon connecting with Twin Peaks. And we've had this whole season, and this is the first time we've seen him do that. So it was nice, and especially the Twin Peaks Police Department. So we transition to Albert and telling Tammy about the first case where it all began, case number one, which was in Olympia, Washington, 1975. Two young field agents, which we will learn in a minute, that are actually Philip and Gordon, they investigated a murder, which brought them to a motel to arrest a suspect named Lois Duffy. While they're outside the motel, a gunshot is heard, and they bust in, and they find that Lois Duffy has been shot in the abdomen. She's dying, and as she's dying, she says, "I'm like the blue rose." And the other woman in the room, who is also Lois Duffy, swears she didn't commit the murder. The one that was shot, she smiles, dies, and then disappears. So maybe she had the allocate ring on also. Or maybe that's what happens to the shadow self when you're killed, too.
Yeah, it kind of melts away.
I like the idea of her having the ring.
Mm-hmm.
That everybody disappears and goes to the lodge. It collects back all of its doppelgangers, if that's in fact what she was.
That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, but you know, it seems like the other Lois, the one that survived, swears she didn't commit the murder, and then while waiting for trial, she hangs herself. I mean, wouldn't a doppelganger shadow self just try to dominate the prison system in some way on the inside or something like that, or just manipulate technology like Mr. C?
I got the impression that the Lois Duffy that actually survived was the real one, because the one who died, who expired, said, "I'm like a blue rose." And then when you get into the conversation, you know, when Albert asks Tammy, "Well, what do you think that means?" And she's saying, "Well, that's unnatural. It's something that doesn't exist in nature." So that would have been the doppelganger.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
I do like how they described Philip and Gordon showing up outside that motel to arrest the suspect, and there is a gunshot heard, because we had something similar in the original series where it's Cooper, Harry, and Andy, isn't it? And Andy drops his gun. They're outside of the motel.
Oh,
and
yeah. And
Catherine.
The little Elvis. I forgot about that.
So after telling Tammy all of this, Albert asks, "What's the one question you should ask me?" And she answers, "What's the significance of the blue rose?" And so she starts this sort of like brainstorming and says, "The blue rose does not occur in nature. It's unnatural. The dying woman was not natural." And she says the word conjured. And then she thinks for a moment and she says, "A tulpa." And a tulpa is like a mind-made body. It originates from Tibetan mythology, where tulpas are described as extra bodies that were created from one person's mind in order to travel to spiritual realms. So I think if we were to like relate this to the show and possibly, you know, what Kent, our listener, has brought up, the Jungian shadow, maybe this is the shadow self of the person made manifest.
So it's like the creation of a doppelganger. Could that also be like what a tulpa is in a way? But a tulpa's, no, I guess it wouldn't be, because a tulpa seems to be created from this definition with an intention and a purpose from the original person. So a doppelganger is just kind of like your shadow self that you can't control, the yin to your yang kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
Because like your shadow is that part of you that you don't really acknowledge and you try not to acknowledge. And the more you do that, the darker it becomes. And so maybe that's part of the problem is not having that, where you're not overseeing it or watching it or keeping it in control.
So they have to meet it halfway for it to be that.
Yeah, like there's just...
Not meet it halfway, like with intention, but by possibly neglect. Like you said, if you don't face it, if you don't confront it, it's like a mold that grows behind something and you're never cleaning it out. So you're kind of complicit in the act of letting it grow.
And that would corroborate the imperfect courage when you're in the lodge. Mm-hmm. And that's why Cooper failed, because of his imperfect courage.
There's all this talk of tulpas and stuff. It made me think of like there's probably a Tom Waits song out there that we've never heard. It's two tulpas from Tulsa on a Tuesday night.
So at this point, Gordon enters announcing it's coffee time. And suddenly there's this window washer that seems really aggressive, especially if you're looking from the perspective of Gordon Cole. And then you look at Gordon Cole and seeing his response to it. I don't know if this is just like setting like a certain tone, like to help agitate us or to make us feel a certain way, or if there's more to it. Is it a commentary on how perspective is everything? Was it code?
I noticed that I had already watched the episode for the third time this afternoon, and Em was watching it for her third time later on, probably about an hour before we podcasted. And I was in another room and I heard this scene, and I was like trying to imagine, well, what is that noise? What's going on? I was like, oh yeah, it's the scene with the window washing. And it reminded me of a louder version of what the chittering that's going on in the jail cell.
Huh.
I don't know if that's here or there, or if that's just what my mind kind of went to because I had just watched the episode recently. But without the visual to let you know what it is, that's what I thought of.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the first time I watched it, I turned it down. You know, I cheated and was like, all right. I felt like him. I was like, where's my volume button? The second and third time, I forced myself to watch it. And I think Em's right. I think it's just to kind of get your angst up to like, okay, now pay attention. This is important. Because really what they give us is a lot of great information. So I think it's just him to like thump you on the forehead and go, okay, watch. You know, this is, make sure you don't miss anything.
It's like these spikes of emotional palate cleanser.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I want that guy to come wash my windows because he was at it. I mean, that was an angry window washer. Somebody pissed him off.
And he was in a hurry, too. He was just he was almost like the shadow of him looked like he was dancing out there.
Right.
You know? A little bit to the left, right. A little bit to the right.
Yeah. And the most time you see windows washers, it's like up and down. I mean, he was all over.
Mm-hmm. Aggressive window washing.
Mm-hmm.
So now Diane enters and she says, Deputy Diane reporting. Gordon asks about that night with Mr. C. She does not want to talk about it. And he says, I understand. I just want to know if he ever mentioned Major Briggs. She says, yes. He gestures towards Albert to bring her up to speed, essentially. But I find it curious that they don't want to know what exactly Mr. C had to say about Major Briggs. They don't even ask her.
Mm-mm.
There's got to be something important about just the fact that he was mentioned. Anything else then becomes irrelevant. Like that's the key right there. If he was mentioned, then whatever suspicion they have is confirmed and they know where to go with that information. So they don't need her to extrapolate. That's the impression I got, but I don't know how that would work out in, you know, real time.
So they need to know, maybe because they can know, it will confirm to them that he was involved in Major Briggs' death in some way.
Oh, yeah.
But it almost seems like this is why they decide to go ahead and give her some information about Major Briggs.
It's the confirmation that he knows about Briggs. You know, like, there was never anything definite before until now, right?
After this is confirmed, Albert brings her up to speed about Major Briggs. He pulls out the ring that was in Major Briggs' stomach, and he tells her about its inscription. Well, it turns out Janie E. is Diane's half-sister, and she hasn't talked to her in years because they are estranged, but she does say that she is married to a Dougie Jones. So I'm assuming that she has only heard that Janie E's married this guy named Dougie Jones, has never seen a wedding picture.
Right.
Hasn't had contact with her for a very long time.
This is where it gets fishy to me. I kind of, after watching it a few times, I've kind of come to the conclusion as a little sketch theory that she doesn't have a half-sister. And it's not, you know, none of that's true. And she was fed this information to give to Gordon and Albert to kind of check off a box in their mind. That way they could get to the Las Vegas part of everything. Mm-hmm. But see, they already know that these people are in Las Vegas. She was just needed to confirm that she knows them somehow, some way. I don't know why that would make it okay for them to go forward, but you have the fact that she's a half sister. So that makes it kind of untraceable by names, because you could say, well, we don't have the same, you know, mom. We just have the same dad, or however that works.
Yeah.
And the fact that, like, it would have come up before that, yeah, my half-sister's husband looks like a slightly heavier version of Dale Cooper. Mm-hmm. Exactly. You know, that this would have been commented on somewhere before that in her mind, and definitely right there at this conversation, but it isn't. So it feels to me like this information was given to her to throw back at them. And I don't know if they know that that's happening, if it is happening, or if they're playing along, or they're playing her, or how it's all working.
Yeah.
It's terribly confusing.
What if she had something to do with Dougie being created, right? Mm-hmm. And she's working for that agent that disappears. What's his name?
Philip Jeffries.
Yeah, let's say she's working with Philip Jeffries, and they kind of knew that Mr. C was out in the wild, and they helped create old Dougie, and she sets her sister up with him, and maybe her sister's pissed off about it, and that's why they're estranged. Waiting for all this to kind of come about all these years later, whenever Coop comes back, and all that kind of gets put into place. Because then that would explain why she wants the FBI to go there, because it still bothers me that Mr. C would want the FBI there. It just doesn't fit.
Maybe Philip Jeffries wants the FBI there.
Yeah, he would want them there to get Coop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, get the good Coop.
Or maybe if she did create him with Philip Jeffries' help and however they ended up doing it, maybe she wanted to be with Dougie because it was a surrogate for Dale, who she might have been in love with, and then he fell for Janie E, and that's why they're estranged, because you know they hate each other for that, or she hates her for that.
Totally possible. I mean, it's just kind of a tack on the wall. Or maybe, because I thought about this, one of, we saw two other people get pulled into vortexes and talk to the fireman, right? One of she got pulled in right after she met Mr. C, and he kind of put her on this path also, because now we know he's willing to pull certain people in to put them on paths to help this whole thing out. So,
yeah,
there's options for our girl. So I like it. It's good.
Yeah. I rather think that she's on a path for good. I don't want the idea of there being pissed offness because you took my baby daddy or whatever. I don't want to do that.
You don't want a baby drama mama?
Yeah.
What? No? Oh, okay. All right. So you guys are saying that it would be like, she could be on par with, say, the way Andy is now after his visit with the fireman, and
or
after
Freddie.
Or Freddie with his glove and stuff. I can see that.
It's totally possible. I think she had something to do with Dougie, you know, or something in that area, or just Philip Jeffries in general. I think there's definitely more clues for her to possibly be good. Even though when she gives the reactions, there's a little bit of a sly look on her face, but I think that's just a red herring to make us think she's evil.
All right. I'll buy it.
I know, I'm trying.
I haven't bought the ticket to the island yet, but I'm kind of hovering around the counter, you know?
Yes. Yeah, because for half a second I thought, oh no, you know, there's that look.
Yeah.
It's not good.
She's
now,
trying to screw him over.
Yeah, exactly. As the episode progresses, there's outs. You know, because somebody had to create Dougie. He just wasn't like I still think it's the giant or what, fireman, fire marshal giant, whatever. Definitely. Fireman. I still think he did it, but maybe he helped facilitate. Maybe. I don't know. I could go around in circles all night over that.
So Gordon gets Tammy to get on the horn so they could get in contact with the Las Vegas office of the FBI. So we actually see the other side of this phone call conversation in Las Vegas headquarters, and Agent Headley is excited to hear from Gordon Cole. So Gordon Cole has this great reputation. But Cole puts him to work immediately, hunting down Douglas Jones. Doesn't mention Janie E, which would definitely be helpful to narrow down the 23. But I've rewound this scene so many times because it cracked me up so hard. Because when Wilson asks, how are we supposed to find the right one? Wilson, how many times have I told you? This is what we do with the FBI.
The pounding on the table is what nails it for me. This is what we do in the FBI. How many times have I told you? Yeah, that little piece of information, if it was given, would kind of negate this scene because you wouldn't need it, because they'd be like, oh, a Douglas Jones married to a Janie E. Jones. There you go. There's probably only one out of those 23 couples that has that going on with it. You would hope. But yeah, just what would the chances of there being? Well, we narrowed it down to five Janie E. and Dougie Jones out there. Now we're going to have to figure out which one of them possibly committed a double homicide.
He just wants them to work for it. That's all.
Yeah. Earn your pay.
Mm-hmm. Diane exits at this point, and then Gordon tells Tammy and Albert about his phone call with Sheriff Truman and his Monica Bellucci dream.
And you notice when he says, and I had another Monica Bellucci dream, and Tammy Preston is just kind of like, her eyebrows arch up like, and then you don't see him say, but you hear Albert go, oh boy. Like he's heard about a few of these, and they probably weren't as
relevant
as this one happened.
They were probably more like my Monica Bellucci dreams.
Right.
So I wondered who Monica Bellucci was going to play. So it turns out she's playing herself. In the dream, Gordon Cole meets Monica at a cafe in Paris. She has friends with her. Cooper is always there, but Gordon cannot see his face. As they're sitting drinking coffee, she says the ancient phrase, "We are like the dreamer who dreams and then lives inside the dream." But she asks, who is the dreamer? Before we move on, I just want to point out how she was running her fingers around the lip of the coffee cup, which is a lot like what Audrey did in the Double R when she was saying that Cooper, isn't he so dreamy?
Oh, yeah.
So if you're going to ask who is the dreamer, there's a clue right there. And Cooper is in the dream, but Gordon can't see him. So I'm going to put my money on Cooper as being the dreamer because of those two two events in that.
Nice.
I almost was going to say Donna just because of a quote from the original series where she says, "It's like I'm having the most beautiful dream and the most horrible nightmare all at once." But that wouldn't be very interesting to me. Have it to be Donna? No.
Yeah. I could take it or leave it with Donna's character, honestly, but to have her be the genesis of all of this, I don't know, that wouldn't feel right.
So after this, Gordon says a powerful and uneasy feeling came over him, and Monica indicates for him to look over his shoulder. So he does, and he sees himself 25 years ago listening to Cooper telling him about a dream he had, which was the day that Philip Jeffries appeared or didn't appear. And we have the scene that was from Fire Walk With Me, mostly. Jeffries comes in, points at Cooper, and he says, "Who do you think that is there?" And it's like Gordon's memory is being jogged right at this moment as he's telling this dream, and he's remembering that particular line, which actually is not the exact line from Fire Walk With Me.
And they hired somebody else to dub their voice in, right?
Right.
Oh, so somebody else dubbed the voice in. Instead of using David Bowie's, they used his physical footage, but they didn't use his vocal footage. And I went back and I did a little Fire Walk With Me research, and it was horrible. I had to watch some of Fire Walk With Me. I would have rather have been doing anything else. Just kidding. I love you. Here's how this scene actually goes. Cooper comes in. He says it's 10:10 a.m. February 16th. And he tells Cole that he's worried about today because of the dream he told you about. Philip Jeffries walks past Cooper as Cooper watches himself in the video feed. So you have two Coopers, because Cooper was going in and out of that video room, right? That was monitoring the hallway. Yeah. And he sticks. So Cooper sees himself. So there's two Coopers going on at that point when Philip Jeffries walks by. He goes into the room and he says, "Well, now, I'm not going to talk about Judy. In fact, we're not going to talk about Judy at all. We're going to keep her out of it." Then he points at Cooper and he says, "Who do you think this is there?" Not "who do you think that is there." He says, "Who do you think this is there?" Don't know why the single word changing is so important, or why it even happened in the first place. Why they just couldn't, they obviously can use Fire Walk With Me footage. They own it, right? Why couldn't they just use this part? So there's something going on there. And he goes on to say, they start showing in this scene in Fire Walk With Me, they start showing the convenience store where the man from another place is talking about Formica and the ring and Garmin Bosia. And behind it, Philip Jeffries keeps talking and he says, "I sure as hell want to tell you everything, but I haven't got a lot to go on. Oh, believe me, I followed it. It was a dream. We live inside a dream." Then he goes on to say, the ring, I was above a convenience store. Listen up, listen carefully. I've been to one of their meetings. Hell, God, baby damn, no. I found something." And then they were there. Then he disappears. And that's when they say, "Oh, he's gone." And they said, "Well, the front desk said he was never here." And then Cooper lets them know, "No, he was here. Look at this." And they still have the footage of him walking by the other Coopers stuck in the hallway. So that's just a little revisit of that particular scene from Fire Walk With Me to kind of jog everybody's memory and to kind of get you thinking, wondering why they changed that. What's the significance of that?
Of that specific line. Yeah. So I'm not sure if it's really worth discussing these semantics, but what's the difference between saying "who is this" and "who is that"?
Wouldn't "who is this" be like somebody can hear you? Like, "Who is this right here?" Like you're asking them, like, "Oh, who is this?" And "who is that" would be like pointing down the street, like, "Who is that?"
Yeah.
That's the only difference I can tell, but I'm no their English major.
"Use this for one object, singular, which is here, near to us. This book is in my hand. Use that for one object, singular, which is there. That is his car. over there. So if it was switched to that, that would say that the person that was in front of Jeffries in this memory of Gordon's is away, is not actually present in the room.
Wow.
Nice.
That makes sense then.
Right? That does make sense.
In its own twisted way.
So when the event happened the first time around and Fire Walk with Me, was Cooper there? And that's why it's this. And now with Gordon's memory, it's now switched to that. Is it because memory's faulty, or is it because his intuition is onto something and that's why the memory of it has changed?
Yeah.
It's emphasis. I think it's emphasis and a little bit of, not necessarily plot device, but, you know, your memory is a little bit faulty. You know, we've talked about that before on this very podcast about how you remember certain things differently than they actually were. And you go back and you watch or read something and it's different than you remember. So it's not completely reliable. But I think the emphasis being on that, with him being away or further away than everybody else in the room, it makes all the difference in the world. So this is the way that Gordon's going to remember it. And this is the way it's going to be presented to us now. And so we have to take it like that going forward. So I don't think that necessarily that the event happened twice. I think that it's just his memory of it is kind of giving us a revamp of how we need to look at it.
Right. Like, this is the update. Yeah. And it was changed in the dream for that purpose, you know?
Right, right.
Yeah. And so that, he was just talking about Dougie being in Vegas and then goes right into this. So it's like kind of the dream pointing him in the direction of old Dougie Jones.
And Albert's also beginning to remember as well. Now at the Twin Peaks Police Department, sandwiches are brought in. They've got lunch boxes ready to load up. And Chad is getting locked up.
Yay!
Yep.
I do wish they had told him what he was being charged with, but maybe read his Miranda rights to him. Just so we can know exactly what they figured out about him.
For sure. You're a jerk.
Yeah. He should have known when there was no sandwich in there for him.
Right.
He comes in, he's like, why is there only four sandwiches? What's going on? You know, Chad, like, he made me mad when he said fuck in that room. Because right. That room's kind of sacred for a Twin Peaks fan. A lot of stuff has gone on in that room. You should have a little bit of reverence for it. And here's this New Jack character going, what the fuck is going on? It's like you're blaspheming. You know, it's like saying goddamn in a church.
Oh.
I do like Officer Andy's cheese sandwich, you know. It fits him. I thought it was kind of sweet. You know, it's like, who ordered a cheese sandwich? And he's all like, oh, I did. I like cheese sandwiches.
So next, Hawk, Bobby, Andy, and Sheriff Truman begin their trek towards Jackrabbit's palace. I wanted to be with them. I wanted to be walking around, hiking those woods.
Hell yeah. This is like the ultimate, like, cool guy Boy Scout adventure ever. I would totally tag along, and I'd be like that little bit. What are we going to do now? What are we going to do now?
I wonder where all of Major Briggs' old equipment ended up.
Are we just supposed to think that most of it burned up in the fire? I mean, it sounds like a lot of that stuff was really high tech. I mean, I'm sure
there was some recovery.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They probably built furniture around it.
They walk for a while, and they eventually come to Jackrabbit's Palace, which is a large, old, broken tree stump.
Oh, yeah. That tree was massive, for sure.
Giant tree stump. Just sounds really unimpressive compared to what we saw.
Yeah.
Well, the thing was huge. You could climb all over it. If you were the size of a jackrabbit, it could be a palace.
I can see why they call it a palace. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty sweet. I almost thought they were going to, like, on The Princess Bride, where they have the dungeon underneath. It's like, oh, is it like a portal itself? Are they going to hit a knot and go down inside of it? You know, but they didn't. I was still pleased with what happened, but a part of me wanted that to happen.
So Andy remembers that they need to put soil in their pockets before they head out due east 253 yards. Eventually, they come upon some smoke, which is obscuring a woman who's lying there. There's also the sound of electricity.
Mm-hmm.
As the camera got closer to the woman, I actually was like, uh-oh, that's Josie Packard.
I thought the same thing for a second. I was like, no, they're not going to do that to us. They're not going to do that to us.
But it actually turns out to be NATO from the original Purple Room, the first woman in there that fell off. And also next to her is a small pool. And instead of having what looks to be burned engine oil, we have more of a glowy orange viscous substance in there.
It almost looks like liquid gold, but that's been polluted somehow with some other stuff that's in there.
Yeah, like some dirt and stuff.
She tries to speak, and she's speaking in that distorted, weird chatter that she had in the, mm-hmm. the purple room. So her being in this realm does not affect how she speaks. It's not distorted by our realm. So somehow her manner of speaking stays true to what we originally saw. But I guess that makes sense because anytime we see Cooper with Laura in the room with the chevron tile and the red curtains, he speaks normally when everybody who is an inhabitant speaks differently.
Ah, good point.
Yeah, it's really good.
Andy immediately is holding her hand, checking on her, where the other three kind of just stand back. And this is when Sheriff Truman says, "It is 2:53, fellas." And overhead, a vortex opens. And Andy is the one that is pulled up into it. If you guys want to speculate as to why?
Because, why Andy? Yeah, maybe he's like the purest of the group. You know, he's, I don't want to call him a simpleton, but he's very kind-hearted. And that he was the first one to kind of go and make sure she was all right and hold her hand and comfort mm-hmm. her. The first thing I could think of was I wanted to apologize to Andy for ever thinking anything that he was up to anything bad, you know, because it really showed his true nature. It's true. And then when he gets pulled up by the giant, it's like, I just felt guilt. He was like, I felt terrible that I thought he was into some kind of, yeah, a bad cop. You know, it felt right to me that he was the one that was drawn up, you know, because we both know Bobby, either him or Hawk, because I don't know enough about this new sheriff. You know, I don't know where his background is. And I know Bobby's kind of had a bit of a shady past, you know, so him or Hawk would have been right. But that it was Andy just seemed right to me. You know, it just seemed like the right thing, that the right person that would be pulled up, just like Cooper being the one that has to talk, that gets to talk to him. It just fit.
I thought it was cool that it was Andy. It was completely unexpected.
I agree.
When you get him up there and you're just like, oh, shit, he's sitting in a chair. And you know the giant's coming over to talk to him. And you're like, oh, this is going to be good. And I think they played it great by not having him say anything at all. Just kind of like be a receptacle of information. Like he's just sucking mm-hmm. it all in. And it does make a lot of sense that it's him. Because if you were to put Hawk up there, which I could see, but he's already got a lot of wisdom going on his end, you know? So talking with Margaret, just being Hawk and who he is, he knows a lot already. So it'd be almost like overkill to give him all that information. You can do more with Andy's character by giving it to him, especially that treat we get when he talks like a authoritative person when he has her in his arms. You've never heard him talk like that, you know, even when he got mad at Albert Rosenfield.
So maybe because he's going to be more receptive to the information in its most purest form, because he's not going to be construing it based on his own perspective and biases.
Yeah.
Not that he doesn't have a perspective, but he doesn't seem to. I mean, even when he's mad at Chad, it's just like this really simple, you're a bad cop. Like there's no
malice,
shades of gray or he takes in information in its most purest form. I don't know how else to explain it.
That makes sense. He doesn't have a filter. He doesn't have a filter that's going to change or give a different angle on any of this information. It's going to come straight in and then straight back out. You know, just the facts kind of thing.
So the giant names himself the fireman, which we've gotten wind about this before because of the soundtrack. I like the fact that he's called a fireman because that means what do firemen do? They put fires out. Fire is associated with Bob.
And he got the warning when the nuclear bomb went off. He had the fire alarm.
Yeah, he did. So there's something that's in Andy's hand now, suddenly. And smoke is overhead, and it begins to contract in on itself. And once it finally does that, he gazes up. And now the angle of the camera has changed, and we can see the ceiling. And we see that there's a skylight sort of above him, but it's not really a skylight. It's actually a silver screen with a nice border around it. And you can actually see that the screen itself has some wear on it. So it looks like a real silver screen.
Yeah.
And so now there's some visual information that's starting to be passed on to Andy. We see the mother, as we first saw her with Tracy and Sam. And then we see her birthing Bob. We see the convenience store. We see the woodsman got a light. Power lines, as if something's traveling over the power lines. We have the screaming student that we see set the tone at the high school for the despair of the news of Laura. We have Laura's homecoming picture bracketed by two angels. And it's also superimposed with the lodge curtains. We see Nato laying in the grass. And then we see Cooper split. A phone is ringing, which I am pretty sure is at the sheriff's department. Well, I'm mostly sure because it has
multiple lines. I'm certain that it is because it's always the one that's blinking. The one that's blinking. How many times have we heard that in the return?
We see Andy escorting Lucy towards something to show something to her. And I don't know. I was looking at the hallway. Could be the hospital. It could be at the sheriff's department. If it's in a hospital, is it Wally? Is it Sheriff Truman?
Oh, wow.
If it's at the sheriff's department, is it her hoard of online shopping crap that's in the room that he's making her face?
You bought all this, Lucy. If it is a hospital, it would have to be Sheriff Truman, I would imagine. Yeah. They don't have puppet hospitals. So,
Andy also sees himself holding Nato's hand, and then he sees the number 6 light pole. As far as what he's holding, it's hard to really describe. I've given it my best shot here. An asymmetrical, vaguely crystalline in shape, possibly made of wood with incense stuck on it.
The incense almost seems to be the method that everything gets to that silver screen. Mm-hmm. Like it's the physicality of it touches the silver screen and it starts the slideshow or whatever it is that you want to call it. And then after it's done, it goes back in and then disappears. And then Andy breathes really quick. Like his body's under a bunch of stress. So there could be something else to Andy going forward, not just the information that was put in his head. There could be something physical that's going on with him too, because we can see that the fireman has, through this episode with Freddie later on, he's marshaling the troops. He's moving things towards their eventual conclusion, or at least getting the people who are going to be integral to getting everything done at that place. And Andy could be part of that. Well, he's now definitely part of it, but he could be part of it in a physical sense and not just a mental sense.
So, okay, I like that. First of all, I like the idea of the smoke rising up and actually creating the silver screen. That's super cool. But what you're saying is corroborating what Paul was saying about Diane. So the giant is marshaling his forces. So maybe Philip Jeffries is in league with the giant and the Philip Jeffries has employed Diane, or Diane is working directly for the giant, also known, I guess we need to start calling him the fireman.
The fireman, yeah. Mm. Well, you know, show me a scene when the fireman has a cell phone and he's texting Diane. I'm there. I'm all there.
Well, that's the reason why I put Philip Jeffries as the middleman, because I can't imagine the fireman would be cell phone technology. It would be just jumbled. She'd just be like, fuck you, fireman.
He's like, yeah. Or Siri trying to understand him when he's trying to audio text. Oh, Lord. I don't understand.
I don't understand. And then he just, you know, because he's always been super patient, like with Cooper, you know. But, like, don't try to do everything at once. A path is laid by laying one stone at a time. You see, we get this scene where he's just like, fuck, and he throws the cell phone against one of the walls.
So once Andy's completed his task here, he just vanishes out of the room, and he arrives back at Jack Rabbit's palace carrying Nato. He's actually walking around. We also see Bobby, Hawk, and Truman walking back to the tree trunk. And it's this really weird scene that they look like woodsmen. They're insubstantive, and there's multiple of them before they kind of just settle into one being that's substantial.
I think the vortex created a ripple effect in the different timelines, because, you know, they have those theories to where everything that could ever happen at a given time from a certain point is always happening. But there's the one reality that, you know, and everybody else has those other realities. You know what I mean? So to bring that down to a smaller level, everybody's timeline was wherever it kind of got pushed out of sync with each other. So you had one, you know, the same person, if that event happened 50 million times or whatever, they would walk just a little bit differently each time back to Jackrabbit's palace from wherever they were at when they saw the vortex happen. And then they coalesce back into the one single timeline. That's how I took it.
So maybe if we were to look at some of the time shifts closely that people have been pointing out, maybe they are all around any time we've seen these vortexes.
Ooh, yeah, that's possible.
Right. Huh. Interesting.
But they did also look like woodsmen too. That was kind of fun.
Yeah.
Like, and they were men in the woods. So they were actually literally woodsmen instead of just dirty hobo bums trying to get a light from people. Why do they got to be so dirty? Maybe that's how you get rid of, you like hose them down. Maybe that's what the fireman's going to do, is he's going to hose them down.
Clean them.
And then when they become clean, they just poof.
I don't know a lot about black holes, but they do have an effect on time because the gravitational pull is so powerful. It actually does slow down time. So maybe there's something different with these vortexes. They maybe operate differently, but they still affect time.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how it felt. It felt like an aftershock to where time had to catch up with itself and get all of its little, it had to get its shit together, you know? And then it was like, all right, cool.
I'd like to know what Bobby and them went through while he was up there.
Yeah.
You know, that's the interesting part to me also.
They weren't quick to move towards NATO, and it's almost like they were, in a way, kind of stunned.
Yeah.
But I think they were also mentally prepared for some weird shit to happen, so that was the first weird thing.
Yeah.
Oh, one thing I really wish we could have seen was Jerry streak by Jack Rabbit's palace or something.
Right? Just running.
So that just totally blows my theory that there is going to be some sort of, he was going to be the person who shows the stakes of going to Jack Rabbit's palace.
Right.
Yeah. What actually happened at Jack Rabbit's palace is, it was awesome. It was a really cool scene. And in a episode that is full of all good scenes, there's there's zero anything in this scene that you feel like you're just kind of waiting through to get to the next scene. Like, okay, this is good, but I know the next thing's going to be great. Everything in this episode was great. So when people talk about the pacing of it, I think we're getting to a pacing that you're more used to with a regular show that moves in a linear fashion. So it's not faster necessarily, only by comparison, I guess I should say. But a lot of people had speculated that Jack Rabbit's palace would be where everything kind of converged and we'd get something climactic that would happen. And it's just a kind of another stop on the way, which I'm fine with because it was a great scene regardless. But so that next scene is still on the way. I also think that one of the reasons, and to go back to our earlier conversation, one of the reasons that Andy got picked might have been because NATO marked him because he's holding onto her hand. What's that?
They touched,
yeah. And they make it a point to show you full screen their hands touching together.
Ooh, that's
like
a good
she's holding
point.
On to him. So maybe she said, okay, fireman, this is the one that you take. And just as an aside, she's the one who fell through the in-between place. Right. She fell out, right?
Yeah.
So she would be the woman who fell to Earth. And this episode has been dedicated to David Bowie.
Nice.
See it in the end credits.
The man who fell there. That's great.
That's awesome. A little piece of me wanted to see like a shadow of Briggs kind of peeking out behind a tree. I know he can't, but like if they had done like a paper cutout, you know? Technically, he would have been there, right? Because he knew it was going to happen.
He was traveling time, but I think there was limited. I think he might have been waiting inside of lodge spaces.
That
and
could
then
be.
Then coming back out into our timeline from time to time. So it's not like he was actually jumping into the future. He was just maybe waiting in lodge spaces as our time went forward.
And watching. That makes sense. I like that.
Yeah, that probably... That is kind of how I pictured it.
Because that would explain why we can't see him now.
Mm-hmm.
Why he wouldn't be involved.
The other option being that he does poke out from around the tree and then he disappears back into a TARDIS. And then
right.
Just...
Or a zipper.
Yeah, it just zips up the screen.
The lodge zipper.
So now Andy, speaking authoritatively, says we need to get her down the mountain. People want her dead. Don't tell anyone about this. And this is all information we didn't see him receive, but he understood all this after being up there with the firemen. And other than Andy, the rest of them do not appear to remember what happened. So they're having like the same aftermath as Bill Hastings had after he had the vortex open or he went into the zone. Now back at the Twin Peaks Sheriff's Department, Andy and Lucy get NATO comfortable in her cell. Andy and Chad trade insults. After Andy and Lucy leave, NATO begins her weird chatter. The cellmate that's drooling in another cell, I wouldn't actually describe that as blood that comes out of his mouth because it has a brownish tinge to it. It could be blood and maybe mixed with scorched engine oil.
And bile.
And spit. Like whatever the little girl in the car was puking out.
Yes,
it might
exactly.
be like a little bit of that, a little bit of blood, a little bit of, but engine oil would be it would be even more disgusting than all of that.
So this is great just desserts for Chad to have to put up with. He's definitely not going to get any sleep. Chad does not mention this guy's name, but I know a lot of people are wondering if it's Billy.
I was too.
It's got to be.
Because of what's said at the freaking the roadhouse at the end of it.
But what if there's a lot of people afflicted? True. You have the girl scratching her armpit.
So does this,
Harry's in the hospital.
So do you guys think that this guy that who we're assuming is Billy, by consensus once again?
I'm not convinced it's Billy. I think it's somebody who's afflicted with the same thing that Billy has been reported to have.
Okay. All right. I can go with that. Do you think this goes back to Sparkle? Do you think this is a Sparkle thing or do you think it's something else?
I think having both Cooper and Mr. C out in the world has devastated not only Cooper, but if he is the dreamer, it's also devastating the world. I think there's a warning embedded in this show.
Yeah.
And I think we're supposed to kind of think about things and think about our darkness and try to fix our hearts, as David Lynch has said as Gordon Cole. I think there's a richer and deeper message that somebody who has lived a long life is trying to help us with by pointing these things out. And that's why there's a subtext about violence. But there's a prescription of hope by telling us to fix our hearts and maybe to figure out our shadow selves and deal with them.
I think you're right. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really good. It's really insightful.
Absolutely.
I like that a lot, actually.
I think Sparkle is helping facilitate it a little faster with some people. Like when you, if you do drugs and you're in there, your immune system is lowered. So whatever viruses are out there, you can catch faster. You know what I mean? So Sparkle's just kind of there to help facilitate. Red, even Red being in town with whatever kind of magic and whoever he is helping kind of bring it to the fever pitch like we had speculated before. You know, so everything, it's exactly what you said. I just think Sparkle's the, almost like the match in the gasoline. You know what I mean? I think it does have a little bit of effect.
Like it's amplifying the problem.
Yeah.
Exactly. Because we still don't know what it is.
Or it's just one of the many components that contribute to it.
For sure.
And then this guy has already received some degree of medical attention in the last 24 hours or so. He has a patch on his cheek. And then it looks like he has one of those oxygen tubes
in
his nose. And it wraps, I don't know if it wraps all the way around his head, but I didn't see a tank anywhere. You just see him drooling as he's repeating everything that everybody else says. Thoroughly disgusting.
And she sounds kind of like a squirrel to me, and he has like a monkey tone to him. You know, it's very interesting to hear. It's almost as if he's the opposite to her, you know, and I doubt it, but it was just interesting to see how it was almost like they were almost communicating at one point. It was interesting. It's too bad they didn't have like a drunk tank or a separate cell block to put her in. You know, I kind of felt bad for her that she's in there with these two guys.
It's Jailhouse Rock, the zoo edition.
Yeah, I guess they couldn't lock her up in a room, but maybe the fireman specifically said a cell for some reason.
Well, I mean, you're not breaking into a cell, you know, unless you have a key.
Yeah.
So even though she's in there with nefarious people, they'd be hard pressed unless they can, you know, go through bars, which we have seen some people do. So
we know that the woodsman can do that. So, but they also have to know that she's there. But it's probably the safest place, because if they just put her in the conference room, she could just get up and start walking around.
Kudos to the special effects people, though. That guy was disgusting.
So we leave that scene, and we're now at the Great Northern. James and Freddie are cracking nuts as they sit out to receive a shipment. They are actually security guards for the Great Northern. This is just, like, immense place. I felt like the scale of it was much more pronounced for some reason at this point, even though you only see just a small part of it.
Well, I understand exactly how that works, though, when you're looking at that. I felt the exact same thing that you did, because you're seeing the I don't know how you would say, like the
loading dock,
the loading dock, but it's you're getting to see the support apparatus of this big monster thing that it is, because you have all the laundry rooms, you have the boiler rooms, you have the electrical rooms, you have the kitchens, you have all of the stuff that all the people behind the scenes make happen in a big endeavor like that, because a hotel has a lot of moving parts to it. A lot of people have to do a lot of different stuff, and they've got these nighttime deliveries, and you need security, and you need things like that. So when you see that, like kind of like looking down the loading dock, and you can see rolling racks and stuff like that for the kitchens and whatnot, you get a better sense of the scale of it than you did in the original series, where you're just basically either in Cooper's room in 315, or you're there in the dining room. You know what I mean? Or you're there in Horn's office.
Yeah.
And those are really like the only places that you get to go. And then at the beginning, you get the shot of the exterior, mm-hmm. or whenever you're letting you know that you're going to have a scene in the Great Northern, you get another shot of the exterior and that's it.
So we learn about why Freddy's wearing this green glove. And I have to say, it's funny that we've got somebody named Freddy wearing a glove and James ends up in a boiler room. Just say.
Is this coincidence?
And then in Bill Hastings' driver's license that he lived on Elm Street.
And I'm ashamed that I didn't put all this together.
Right.
That was one of my earliest and most favorite horror movies was the original Nightmare on Elm Street. So shame on me. But M got it. So
that's awesome. I didn't even think about that. It's still in the podcast.
We're still keeping it in the band.
So before we get to the boiler room, though, Freddy eventually tells James, or Jimmy, as he's calling him, how he ended up with his green glove in the first place and why he's got this superhuman strength. James tells him that it's his birthday. And we don't have to go too much into this, but James' birthday is January 1st. Jack Rabbit's Palace is supposed to happen October 1st, October 2nd time frame. So maybe the vortex did something with time. But it doesn't look like January, though, weather-wise.
He could have been lying to him just to hear the story. I mean, it's possible. He knew. Go ahead.
Do you think they wanted us to know the date?
Could be.
Okay. Let's just play devil's advocate just for a quick second here and say that, okay, it is January 1st then, right? Mm-hmm. They're way out of sync with everybody else because everybody else is 10 months ahead of them.
Yeah.
Because the timeline that's going on with Jack Rabbit's Palace, those people are intrinsically tied in with other plot lines that are obviously not lagging 10 months behind. So what would be the significance of these two people and this story happening to be told 10 months prior?
Maybe the arrival of the tone.
Yeah, because he hears the tone when he goes in. Or is it the tone just like underneath the offices or going through the electrical outlets or wherever? You know, that to me, that synced it up with what's going on in the office. Because in the office, you can barely hear it. Now, when he goes down there and he sees that door, he can really hear it. So it's kind of like a part of the hotel that nobody goes to. You know what I mean? So that, to me, synced it up with what's going on with the Horn office, you know? But I could be wrong.
Also, a lot of stuff, the majority of stuff that happens in Nightmare on Elm Street happens in a dream.
Mm, yeah.
That's a good point.
But if it's January 1st, they're in Washington State, they're not going to be able to sit out there after dark in regular police uniforms and not freeze to death. We would have seen their breath. We would have seen. Now, early October, they might be a little bit chilly, but it's doable.
It's a good point.
He's either lying or maybe they're not really paying attention to details, possibly.
It's possible. All right, so what do you think he's going to have to do with that super strong rubber dishwashing glove of his?
He's going to have to hit Mr. C right in the breadbasket.
Arm wrestling?
I don't know. arm wrestling and win.
I don't know.
That would be arm strength, though. That wouldn't be hand strength.
I don't know. I was curious because it'd be cool if it was like a flame retardant glove, but then that would be for that purpose, that he's super strong. The strength of a jackhammer. I mean, it's going to be interesting. Somebody's going to be trapped and he's got to break into it. Maybe he's got to break into that door. I don't know. It's going to be interesting to bring this guy out of left field, give him a story with the fireman after we just saw it, and then give him super strong right hand. You know, it was a lot in just one clip.
Well, we saw this guy earlier in one of the very early parts. I think maybe the first or second one when he's hanging out with James. And that's when Shelly looks over and says,
first episode,
says
right?
James has always been cool.
Second
episode. Yeah. And he had the glove on. And I was like, I remember saying, I think I even said it on the podcast, like, what is James doing hanging out with this weirdo with a green glove on at the bar? You know, and now we know. So it's possible that he's a bookhouse boy as well at this point, because if he's hanging out with James on the off time and he's cool enough and it looks like he can handle it, he might be brought into the fold.
There has been no talk of the bookhouse boys. It's almost like they've disbanded.
Yeah.
I refuse to believe that.
It's just the bookhouse boy.
The bookhouse boy, singular. 1, 2, James is coming for you.
So, yeah, so it sounds like there's a kind of like a Marvel League that's starting to form,
which
is interesting. And so I'm looking forward to see how that unfolds. And it's going to be beyond what I could imagine, because if you have an arm wrestling match that is written in a way that I would never imagine to be written, this is going to be also the same way.
Yep.
So James goes to check the furnace. We've already talked a little about this. The tone that was in Beverly's office is really pronounced in here. He follows it to a door, and I notice that the door has some light reflections on it, but right at the doorknob, it's a gold orb light reflection right on it.
I totally missed that.
Yeah. So maybe the tone is related to Laura.
She's coming through there. Oh, that'd be awesome. She's got to. I mean, she's got to come back for what happens in the upcoming scenes, you know?
That would make her the lady in the radiator, or related to a variation on the theme. I like that. I mean, it's a boiler room or whatever, I guess you call it, the furnace room, but we'll see.
So now we're to my favorite scene of this episode. Sarah Palmer walks into Elk's Point number 9 bar, and she sidles up to a stool and orders a Bloody Mary. A man down the bar in a Truck U shirt sidles up next to her, wanting to hook up. He's like misogyny personified.
Yes. Creep.
He just can't handle rejection, and the woman hater underneath comes spiking out.
You know, all the times that I've been rejected in my life by a woman, I've never gone to that. It's never been my first thought to be like, she must be a lesbian. That's why she's like,
me either, man. Usually I'm like, all right, fine, hoping for that little glimmer of hope that maybe down the road they might be desperate enough to get with me. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, well, that guy's just a dick, though, and he's a you know, I took it as he was the drunk in the corner too, and just like M said, you know, he's just a bastard. You know, especially when he drops the C word, you know, it's like, come on, dude. Come on. Be nice.
Well, Sarah tried to get him to go back down the bar.
Exactly.
But he kept insisting. And then he starts saying, like, you like to eat cunt. And she says, I'll eat you. And just to truncate the scene quickly, she pulls her face off. Inside her face, we see black smoke, electrical pulses, a demon mouth with a lashing stiletto tongue, a left hand with a diseased and bloated ring finger, which is also known as the spiritual mound. We see a smiling mouth, and that's up for debate whose smiling mouth that is. She then puts her face back on, bites off his neck. She doesn't have any evidence of it on her face. I wonder if she did a quick swallow.
Oh, yeah.
Of the flesh that she pulled off.
It's insane.
The idea that's gross. Yes. And once he's down on the ground, she screams, and the bartender comes over, and he's suspicious. He yells someone to call 911. He says to her, we'll see about this. And she says, yeah, sure is a mystery, huh? So,
man.
I mean, what more confirmation do we need about Bob being within or associated with Sarah Palmer?
Now, see, here's the thing, though. I know.
Really?
Yeah, I know, because it was my idea. But did Bob ever pull his face off?
No.
See?
Nobody ever did.
She's the complete opposite of Laura, or her daughter. Mm-hmm. So I think she's the level above Bob. Maybe she's the mother Earth because of the it's like everything bad is inside of her, you know, and the way that she acts. I think Bob would have had fun with it, maybe kept the blood. That it was extra magic that she's, I mean, not a drop. She even avoids it at one point on the ground. She like skips back like, oh, you know, what the hell? I don't know. Just something makes me feel that it's the mother.
I think you're right, because when I think about that stiletto tongue that like lashed out, it's like a snake. Mm-hmm. So like the mother would be the head of the snake that you have to kill to destroy the whole root of the problem.
Yeah.
Like Bob is not the root of the problem.
No, it's her, right?
He could be seen as almost a minion.
Yeah.
Just kind of going around and doing what he wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
So we did see somebody else take off their face though, because Laura did the same thing.
Yeah. And then Laura is going to have to come back and fight her mom, right?
Yeah. But honestly, Sarah Palmer died a long time ago.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
So, I mean, you lose your daughter, then you lose your husband.
What if it's Laura saves her mother? Why does it have to be killed?
I'm good with that. I would watch 3 hours of like a horror movie with just Sarah Palmer going around town. She's good and she's scary without any special effects. Just the looks she gives you is terrifying.
I mean, wouldn't violence and killing almost feed the mother, where if Laura like laid down her life or sacrificed herself in some way would actually be the true way to defeat it?
Yeah, I mean,
because that would be love.
Yeah, yeah, Luke Skywalker, that shit.
I can kind of see it, but the mother feels like an elemental force that you have to
destroy.
Have some sort of you have to get out of its way, or you have to find a way to stop it. And it would almost be like saying you have to just love the hurricane, you know, because it wouldn't. I know we're dealing it just feels like some apples and oranges. I know, but
it would be more than just her. Throwing down her body in front of her mother in prostrate grief and love. I think it would require more, but I think whatever she does, I don't think it should come from a place of violence. Mm.
Yeah, I would be actually surprised if we see
the fight
incarnation of Laura in a fight. That doesn't really seem like how that would go down.
For sure.
Maybe that's what we have Freddy's hand for. You know, so he not to punch out. Month, maybe. No, you know, it's a pile. It has a pile driver strength. He's gonna be hitting something with it.
Yeah, maybe so, he's got to bust through something in the owl cave. I don't know. I mean, I
thought of that too. Like, if there's an avalanche in the owl cave, he has to just like move all the rocks or something.
I don't know. Yeah, it's gonna be interesting to see what his story pans out. But she's a frightening woman. I mean, even the bartender steps back like, oh fuck. All right, you can just go and leave. Please don't come back.
Yeah.
Please.
We don't know what happened to this guy. That's what we're going to tell
them. And even everybody in that bar, they come and like look around. I'm in a bar where someone gets their throat bit out. I'm out the door running down the street to my car and I'm leaving. I'd probably be the first one to get killed in the parking lot, to be honest with you, if they're out there waiting. I don't know. I couldn't just be like, oh, look, his neck's gone. Mm-mm. It's no way.
No one else has left yet and the door is banging behind Paul.
Oh, yeah. I'm no hero. Get me out of here.
So next we're in the final scene at the Roadhouse, and we have Megan and Sophie in the Frank booth talking. It's actually Sophie who asks, have you seen Billy? Because she heard that Megan was the last person to see Billy. And at first you're like, is this person Tina? You know, but you figure out that Megan's actually Tina's daughter as our conversation goes forth. Sophie does ask what your mother's name is. And when she says Tina, I thought Sophie's face was pensive about this for some reason.
I thought it was weird that she was asking in the first place. I mean, I don't know all of my friends' like parents' names.
Yeah,
I couldn't tell you that. So maybe it's not so weird, but it just seemed like she was letting some pieces were falling into place in her mind when she got that piece of information.
Maybe Billy's been hooking up with a lot of ladies.
Yeah.
Apparently.
It sounds like he had been hooking up with Tina not long before he was hooking up with Audrey.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe overlap.
Ooh.
That's why he's got that stuff coming out of his mouth. He's been around.
Yeah, he's got a venereal disease. It has nothing to do with Sparkle. Yeah.
And twice Megan says, I don't know if my uncle was there. I can't remember if my uncle was there.
Yeah.
That's really curious because that goes back to Fire Walk With Me. With in front of Will, the uncle was missing from that conversation. And then we just had the strange French woman, Will scenario and a strange conversation that caused me to recall that conversation about the uncle again. So I don't know who this guy is. I want to find out hopefully soon.
Yeah, right.
So anything else you guys want to say about this scene?
They're having a lot of fun with this Frank booth. Just getting to the end of an episode. It's enough. You get enough in each part of the return to digest as it is. And then right at the end of it, they throw you two characters you've never seen before talking about other characters who you've never seen before.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a fun puzzle to try to put together. Though, you know, well, like, okay, how does this person connect with that person? And who could this possibly be?
What about the implications to Audrey? So now we know that Audrey was talking about real people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, so.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Unless everything's a dream.
But if everything's a dream, that means everything is real at the same time. Now, I know that sounds silly, but think about it. Because if everything's a dream, that's the dream is all we have. So it has to be real or else none of it.
None of it happened at all.
If you get to the last 10 seconds and you go, that was all a dream. Well, it all still happened because we just watched 17 weeks of it. So you know,
that brings me to the actual full quote of the ancient phrase that Monica Bellucci said in the dream, which is from the Upanishad, which the full quote of what she said is, we are like the spider. We weave our life and then move along in it. We are like the dreamer who dreams and then lives in the dream. This is true for the entire universe. And Lynch has also used this as a clue that he's offered in a form of a quotation when asked to explain his film Inland Empire, by the way.
Oh. I am the arm, and I sound like this. That's my response to that. No. So what is that? I mean, really, when you get down to it, what is that trying to say? Like, everybody creates their own framework of reality that they exist in. So
I think it's life is but a dream. Hmm. Row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Life is but a dream.
Take this back to Audrey. She's still, well, because they bring up the insane asylum while they're talking, right? Because that girl's been doing drugs there.
The nut house, yeah.
The nut house. So maybe Audrey is in the nut house. I don't know. I don't know how this affects Audrey or not.
I felt like nut house was a reference to wherever she lives. Mm-hmm. And it's a crazy place and there's a bunch of crazy ass people in there all the time. And she's like, well, I'm in my room, you know, because they don't let you out of the nut house to just go have a beer at the courthouse.
That's a good point.
You know, I think it was a reference to just a crazy place where she lives. Because, I mean, she said that the guy who, Billy, had come into their house, let a bunch of blood go into their sink, looked at them really crazy and left. So that would contribute to that being in that house.
Maybe Charlie's her uncle.
Oh, wow. Huh.
This is going to be super fun when we have all of the information end of it and go back and watch it. And all of these little Frank Booth scenes are going to make a whole hell of a lot more sense in the bigger picture.
Now, the music was Lizzie singing Wild West, which is this really high energy song. But it was really weird and off-putting in the sense that she was not always close to her mic, and I felt like it should have affected her voice. And I've never really felt that way watching a live, in quotations, performance before. Even when people are pretending to be live and they're not actually live, they still do a better job as like being close to the mic. So I was wondering if this was on purpose. It's showing like the separation of reality from unreality.
It could.
Yeah, she just didn't give a fuck that it wouldn't have synced up like that, because she was quite a ways away from her microphone at certain points in her vocal line.
Now,
so
I don't know, because when people are hitting, was it the really big notes she was kind of pulling back?
No, it would be a constant.
It was a constant thing. Oh, okay. Well, then, yeah, that was definitely, I just don't think she gave a shit, but it damn sure could. With it being Twin Peaks, it could be exactly what Emma's talking about also. I wouldn't put it past it that even in the music, it would be that way.
Well, even with James's performance, it was obvious to us because we're so familiar with that song that it was the same song, but they didn't even bother to try to have a band behind them, even though you actually have a band performing in that song.
Right.
You can hear the bass guitar pretty prominently, but the only people on stage are actually James's guitar and the Maddie and Donna stand-ins. Mm-hmm. Neither one of them had a guitar, so.
So, yeah, I think that's something that relates to Mulholland Drive.
Okay.
With the no high Bonda.
Yeah.
So, with that in mind, what do you think the next episode is going to hold in store as far as tone? Do you think we're going to get an acceleration of the storyline?
Yeah, I think it's picking up, because I think this episode was much faster in pace, and then ending on that song, which has so much energy, seems like that's like momentum that's going to push us forward into the next and to the final four, which is actually 3 weeks only left.
And if this is built like a movie, this is the last 30-40 minutes of it. You know, it's the climax of the movie, so it's just going to be awesome from here on out. Mm-hmm. I'm expecting the downward. We're hitting that bottom slope of the roller coaster. I cannot absolutely wait for each episode now. Mm-hmm. Not that I couldn't before, but this one really was awesome. I mean, it's my favorite one of the season so far. It was fantastic.
It might be my favorite. I'm not sure, because there's been a lot of other ones. There's been quite a few. There's
good ones
in there that could contend with that. But yeah, everything was good. I mean, just going out with the Boy Scouts,
hanging
out with them, the Blue Rose stuff at the beginning. I mean, Sarah Palmer, obviously. Freddie's story about his hand.
Mm-hmm. The only thing missing was a little Dougie.
Yeah.
And this is how we Dougie.
This was the... We still did get that. So technically, Colin Glockman was in this episode because you see his face both as Mr. C and Dougie. Mm-hmm. But other than that, it's just like from a couple of parts ago when there was only the Game of Throw that he was playing with Sonny Jim. And that was it. So that's two episodes now that he really hasn't had a presence in besides that token little bit just to say, yes, he was in it.
In the dream sequence, he was in that too for like a second as his younger self.
Yeah, yeah, okay, yeah.
But so that's still like nothing footage, though, compared to what he's been doing.
All right, so that was our coverage of Twin Peaks The Return, Part 14. Join us in a couple of days for our feedback podcast where we can talk about everything that you guys thought about this episode.
All right, this was the No Ship Network podcast. I am your host, Em.
I'm your host, Steve.
And I'm your host, Paul.
We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds.
Shut up! Shut up, goddammit!